Initially, staying on the move in that motionless world seemed to be the wisest thing they could do. If Tick-Tock was faithful to his promise, using only his eyes and ears and wits to track them, their safety increased in direct proportion to the amount of distance they put between him and them. As Harry ran with Connie from one lonely street to another, he suspected that there was a better than even chance that the psycho would keep his word, stalking them only by ordinary means and releasing them unharmed from the paws if he could not catch them in 1 hour of real time. The bastard was, after all, demonstrably immature in spite of his incredible power, a child playing a game, and sometimes children took games more seriously than real life. Of course, when he released them, it would still be 1:29 in the morning when clocks finally started ticking again. Dawn remained 5 hours away. And while Tick-Tock might play this particular game within a game strictly according to the rules he had outlined, he would still intend to kill them by dawn. Surviving the pause would only win them the slim chance to find him and destroy him once time started up again. And even if Tick-Tock broke his promise, using some sixth sense to track them, it was smart to keep moving. Perhaps he had pinned psychic tags on them, as Harry had speculated earlier, in which case, if he did cheat, he could find them regardless of where they went. By remaining on the move, at least they were safe unless and until he could catch them or get ahead by anticipating their next turn. From street to alley to street, across yards and between silent houses, they ran, clambering over fences through a school playground, footfalls vaguely metallic, where every shadow seemed as permanent as iron, where neon lights burned steadier than any Harry had ever seen before and painted eternal rainbows on the pavement, past a man in a tweed coat walking his Scotty dog, and both of them as motionless as bronze figures. They sprinted along a narrow stream bed where runoff from the storm earlier in the day was time-frozen but not at all like ice, clearer than ice, black with reflections of the night and marked by pure silver highlights instead of frost-white crystallization. The surface was not flat either, like a frozen winter creek, but rippled and runneled and spiraled by turbulence. Where the stream splashed over rocks in its course, the air was hung with unmoving sprays of glittering water resembling elaborate sculptures made from glass shards and beads. Though staying on the move was desirable, continued flight soon became impractical. They were already tired and stiff with pain when they began their run. Each additional exertion took a geometrically greater toll from them. Although they seemed to move as easily in this petrified world as in the one to which they were accustomed, Harry noticed that they did not create a wind of their own when they ran. The air parted around them like butter around a knife, but no turbulence arose from their passage, which indicated that the air was objectively denser than it appeared subjectively. Their speed might be considerably less than it appeared to them, in which case movement required more effort than they perceived. Furthermore, the coffee, brandy, and hamburger that Harry had eaten churned sourly in his stomach. Acidic flares of indigestion burned through his chest. More important, block by block, as they fled through that town-sized mausoleum, an inexplicable inversion of biological response increased their misery. Although such strenuous activity should have left them overheated, they grew steadily colder. Harry couldn't work up a sweat, not even an icy one. His toes and fingers felt as if he had slogged across an Alaskan glacier, not a Southern California beach resort. The night itself felt no colder than before the pause. Indeed, perhaps not quite as cool, since the crisp breeze off the ocean had fallen into stillness with everything else. The cause of the queer internal chill was evidently other than the air temperature, more mysterious and profound, and frightening. It was as if the world around them, its abundant energy trapped in stasis, had become a black hole of sorts, relentlessly absorbing their energy, sucking it out of them until degree by degree they would become as inanimate as everything else. He suspected it was imperative that they begin to conserve what resources they had left. When it became incontrovertibly clear that they would have to stop and find a promising place to hide, they had left a residential neighborhood and entered the east end of a canyon with scrub-covered slopes. Along the three-lane service road, lit by rows of sodium vapor arc lamps that transformed the night into a two-tone black and yellow canvas, the flat ground was occupied by semi-industrial businesses of the type that image-conscious towns like Laguna Beach carefully tucked away from primary tourist routes. They were walking now, shivering. She was hugging herself. He turned his collar and pulled the halves of his sport coat tight together. How much of the hour has passed? Connie asked. Damned if I know. I've lost all time sense. Half an hour? Maybe. Longer? Maybe. Less? Maybe. Shit. Maybe. To their right, in a sprawling recreational vehicle storage yard behind heavy-duty chain-link fence crowned with razor wire, motorhomes stood side by side in the gloom, like row after row of slumbering elephants. What are all these cars? Connie wondered. They were parked on both sides of the road, half on the narrow shoulders and half on the pavement, squeezing the three-lane street to no more than two lanes. It was curious because none of those businesses would have been open when the pause hit. In fact, all of them were dark and had closed up 7 to 8 hours earlier. On their right, a landscape maintenance company occupying a concrete block building behind a tree and shrub nursery was terraced halfway up the canyon wall. Directly under one of the pole lamps, they came upon a car in which a young couple was necking. Her blouse was open and his hand was inside, marble palm cupping marble breast. As far as Harry was concerned, their frozen expressions of ardent passion, tinted sodium yellow and glimpsed through the car windows, was about as erotic as a couple of corpses tumbled together on a bed. They passed two automobile repair shops on opposite sides of the three-lane, each specializing in different foreign makes. The business fronted their own parts junkyards, heaped with cannibalized vehicles and fenced with high chain link. Cars continued to line the street, blocking driveways to the businesses. A boy of about 18 or 19, shirtless in jeans and Rockports, as thoroughly gripped by the paws as everyone they had seen thus far, was sprawled across the hood of a black 86 Camaro, arms out to his sides and palms up, staring at the occluded sky as if there was something to see up there, a stupid expression of drugged-out bliss on his face. "This is weird," Connie said. "Weird," Harry agreed, flexing his hands to keep the knuckles from growing too stiff with the cold. "But you know what? Familiar somehow," he said. "Yeah." Along the final length of the three-lane blacktop, all of the businesses were warehouses. Some were built of concrete block covered with dust-caked stucco, stained with rust from water pouring off corrugated metal roofs during countless rainy seasons. Others were entirely of metal, like Quonset huts. The parked cars grew more numerous in the final block of the street, which dead-ended in the crotch of the canyon. In some places, they were doubled up, narrowing the road to one lane. At the end of the street, the last of all the buildings was a large warehouse unidentified by any company name. It was one of the stucco-coated models with a corrugated steel roof. A giant for-rent banner was flung across the front with a realtor's phone number. Security lights shone down the face of the structure across metal roll-up doors large enough to admit big tractor and trailer rigs. At the southwest corner of the building was a smaller, man-sized door at which stood two tough-looking guys in their early 20s, steroid-assisted physiques bulked up beyond what weightlifting and diet alone could achieve. "Couple of bouncers," Connie said, as they approached the pause-frozen men. Suddenly, the scene made sense to Harry. "It's a rave." "On a weekday?" "Must be someone's special party, birthday or something." Imported from England a few years ago, the rave phenomenon appealed to teenagers and those in their early 20s who wanted to party non-stop until dawn, beyond the eye of all authorities. "Smart place to hide?" Connie wondered. "As smart as any, I guess, and smarter than some." Rave promoters rented warehouses and industrial buildings for a night or two, moving the event from one spot to another to avoid police detection. Locations of upcoming raves were advertised in underground newspapers and in flyers handed out at record stores, nightclubs, and schools, all written in the code of the subculture using phrases like the Mickey Mouse Express, American Express, Double Hit Mickey, Get X-Rayed, Dental Surgery Explained, and Free Balloons for the Kiddies. Mickey Mouse and X were nicknames for a potent drug, more commonly known as ecstasy, while references to dentistry and balloons meant that nitrous oxide, or laughing gas, would be for sale. Avoidance of police detection was essential. The theme of every illegal rave party, as opposed to tamer imitations in the legitimate rave nightclubs, was sex, drugs, and anarchy. Harry and Connie walked past the bouncers through the door and into the heart of chaos, but a chaos to which the pause had brought a tenuous and artificial order. The cavernous room was lit by a half a dozen red and green lasers, perhaps a dozen yellow and red spots, and strobes, all of which had been blinking and sweeping over the crowd until the pause had stilled them. Now lances of colorful fixed light found some partiers and left others in shadows. 400 or 500 people, mostly between 18 and 25, but some as young as 15, were frozen in either the act of dancing or just hanging out. Because the disc jockeys at raves invariably played highly energized techno dance music with a rapidly pounding bass that could shake walls, many of the young celebrants had been paused in bizarre poses of flailing and gyrating abandon, bodies contorted, hair flying. The men and boys were for the most part dressed in jeans or chinos with flannel shirts and baseball caps worn backward, or with preppy sport coats over t-shirts, though some were decked out all in black. The girls and young women wore a wider variety of clothes, but every outfit was provocative, tight, short, low-cut, translucent, revealing. Raves were, after all, celebrations of the carnal. The silence of graves had replaced the booming music, as well as the screams and shouts of the partiers. The eerie light combined with the stillness to impart an anti-erotic, cadaverous quality to the exposed curves of calves, thighs, and breasts. As he and Connie moved through the crowd, Harry noticed that the dancers' faces were stretched in grotesque expressions which had probably conveyed excitement and hopped-up gaiety when they were animated. In freeze frame, however, they were eerily transformed into masks of rage, hatred, and agony. In the fiery glow produced by the lasers and spots, and by the psychedelic images that film projectors beamed onto two huge walls, it was easy to imagine that this was no party after all, but a diorama of hell, and with the damned writhing in pain and waiting for release from their excruciating torment. By saning out the rave's noise and movement, the pause might have captured the truth of the event in its net. Perhaps the ugly secret, beneath the flash and thunder, was that these revelers, in their obsessive search for sensation, were not truly having fun on any fundamental level, but were suffering private miseries from which they frantically sought relief that eluded them. Harry led Connie out of the dancers into the spectators who were gathered around the perimeter of the enormous vaulted chamber. A few had been caught by the pause in small groups, in the midst of shouted conversations and exaggerated laughter, faces strained and muscles corded in their necks as they struggled to compete with the thunderous music. But most seemed to be alone, disengaged from those around them. Some were slack-faced and staring vacuously into the crowd. Others were as taut as stretched wire, with unnervingly feverish stares. Perhaps it was the Halloween lighting and the stark shadows, but in either case, whether hollow-eyed or glaring, the petrified ravers on the sidelines reminded Harry of movie zombies, paralyzed in the middle of some murderous task. "It's a regular creep show," Connie said uneasily, evidently also perceiving a quality of menace in the scene that might not have been so obvious if they had wandered into it before the pause. "Welcome to the 90s. A number of the zombies on the periphery of the dance floor were holding balloons in an array of bright colors, though not attached to strings or sticks. Here was a red-haired, freckled boy of 17 or 18 who had stretched the neck of a canary-yellow balloon and wrapped it around his index finger to prevent deflation. And here was a young man with a Pancho Villa mustache firmly pinching the neck of a green balloon between thumb and forefinger, as was a blonde girl with empty blue eyes. Those who didn't use their fingers seemed to employ the type of hinged binder clips that could be bought by the box at stationery stores. A few ravers had the necks of their balloons between their lips taking hits of nitrous oxide, which they had bought from a vendor who was no doubt working out of a van behind the building. With all the vacant or intense stares and the bright balloons, it was as if a pack of the walking dead had wandered into a children's birthday party. Although the scene was made infinitely strange and fascinating by the pause, it was still drearily familiar to Harry. He was, after all, a homicide detective, and sudden deaths occasionally occurred at raves. Sometimes they were drug overdoses. No dentist would sedate a patient with a concentration of nitrous oxide higher than 80%, but the gas available at raves was often pure, with no oxygen mixed in. Take too many hits of the pure stuff in too short a time, or suck too long on one toke, you might not merely make a giggling spectacle of yourself, but induce a stroke that killed you, or worse, one that was not fatal, but caused irreparable brain damage and left you flopping like a fish on the floor, or catatonic. Harry spotted a loft overhanging the entire width of the back of the warehouse, 20 feet above the main floor, with wooden steps leading to it from both ends. Up there, he told Connie, pointing. They would be able to see the entire warehouse from that high deck and quickly spot Tick-Tock if they heard him enter, no matter which door he used. The two staircases ensured an escape route regardless of the direction from which he came at them. Moving deeper into the building, they passed two bosomy young women in tight T-shirts on which were printed, "Just Say No," a rave joke on Nancy Reagan's anti-drug campaign, which meant these two said yes to nitrous oxide, N-O, if not to anything else. They had to step around three girls lying on the floor near the wall, two of them holding half-deflated balloons and paused in fits of red-faced giggles. The third was unconscious, mouth open, a fully deflated balloon on her chest. Near the back, not far from the right-hand stairs, an enormous white X was painted on the wall, large enough to be visible from every corner of the warehouse. Two guys in Mickey Mouse sweatshirts, and one of them in a mouse ear hat, had been frozen in the middle of bustling commerce, taking $20 bills from customers in return for capsules of ecstasy or for disco biscuits saturated with the same stuff. They came to a teenager, no more than 15, with guileless eyes and a face as innocent as that of a young nun. She was wearing a black T-shirt with a picture of a shotgun under the words, "Pump Action." She had paused in the process of putting a disco biscuit into her mouth. Connie plucked the cookie from the girl's stiff fingers and slipped it out from between her parted lips. She threw it to the floor. The cookie didn't have quite enough momentum to carry it all the way down, halting inches above the concrete. Connie pushed it the rest of the way with the toe of her shoe and crushed it underfoot.
"Stupid kid."
"This isn't like you," Harry said.
"What?"
"Being a stuffy adult."
"Maybe someone's got to."
Methylene dioxymethamphetamine, or ecstasy, an amphetamine with hallucinogenic effects, could radically energize the user and induce euphoria. It could also generate a false sense of profound intimacy with any strangers in whose company the user happened to be when high. Although other drugs sometimes appeared at raves, N.O. and ecstasy were far and away predominant. N.O. was just non-addictive giggle juice, wasn't it? And ecstasy could bring you into harmony with your fellow human beings and put you in tune with Mother Nature, right? That was its rep. The chosen drug of ecologically minded peace advocates well consumed at rallies to save the planet. Sure, it was dangerous for people with heart conditions, but there was no recorded death from its use in the entire United States. True, scientists had recently discovered that ecstasy caused pin-sized holes in the brain, hundreds or even thousands of them from continued use. But there was no proof that these holes resulted in diminished mental capacity, so what they probably did see was let the cosmic rays shine in better and assist enlightenment, right? Climbing to the loft, Harry could look down between the steps, which had treads but no risers, and see couples frozen in makeout postures in the shadows under the staircase. All the sex education in the world, all the graphic pamphlets on condom use, could be swept aside by one tab of ecstasy if the user experienced an erotic response, as so many did. How could you remain concerned about disease when the stranger you just met was such a soulmate, the yin to your yang, radiant and pure to your third eye, so in tune to your every need and desire? When he and Connie reached the loft, the light was dimmer than on the main level, but Harry could see couples lying on the floor or sitting together with their backs against the rear wall. They were making out more aggressively than those beneath the stairs, paused in tongue duels, blouses unbuttoned, jeans unzipped, hands seeking within. Two or three of the couples, in an ecstasy rush, might even have lost such complete touch with where they were and with common propriety that they were actually doing it in one fashion or another when the pause hit. Harry had no desire to confirm that suspicion. Like the sad circus on the main floor, the scene in the loft was only depressing. It was not in the least erotic to any voyeur with minimum standards, but provoked as many somber thoughts as any Hieronymus Bosch painting of hellacious realms and creatures. As Harry and Connie moved between the couples toward the loft railing where they could look down on the floor, he said, "Be careful what you step in."
"You're disgusting."
"Only trying to be a gentleman."
"Well, that's unique in this place."
From the railing, they had a good view of the frozen throng below, partying eternally. Connie said,
"God, I'm cold."
"Me too."
Standing side by side, they put their arms around each other at the waist, ostensibly sharing body heat. Harry had rarely in his life felt as close to anyone as he felt to her at that moment. Not close in an amorous sense. The stoned and groping couples on the floor behind them were sufficiently anti-romantic to ensure against any romantic feelings rising in him just then. The atmosphere wasn't right for it. What he felt instead was the platonic closeness of friend to friend, of partners who had been pushed to their limits and then beyond, who were very probably going to die together before dawn, and this was the important part, without either of them ever having decided what he really wanted out of life or what it all meant. She said, "Tell me not all kids these days go to places like this, saturate their brains with chemicals." "They don't. Not all of them. Not even most of them. Most kids are reasonably together. Because I wouldn't want to think that this crowd is typical of our next generation of leaders, as they say." "It isn't." "If it is," she said, "then the post-millennium cotillion is going to be even nastier than what we've been living through these last few years." "Ecstasy causes pin-size holes in the brain," he said. "I know. Just imagine how more inept the government would be if the Congress was full of boys and girls who like to ride the express." "What makes you think it isn't already?" She laughed sourly. "That would explain a lot." The air was neither cold nor warm, but they were shivering worse than ever. The warehouse remained deathly still. "I'm sorry about your condo," she said.
"What?"
"It burned down, remember?"
"Well..." He shrugged.
"I know how much you loved it."
"There's insurance."
"Still, it was so nice, cozy, everything in its place."
"Oh? The one time you were there, you said it was the perfect self-constructed prison, and that I was a shining example to every anal-retentive nutcase fuss budget from Boston to San Diego."
"No, I didn't."
"Yes, you did."
"Really?"
"Well, you were angry with me."
"I must have been." "About what?"
He said, "That was the day we arrested Norton Lewis. He gave us a little run for our money, and I wouldn't let you shoot him."
"That's right. God, I really wanted to shoot him."
"Wasn't necessary," she sighed.
"I was really up for it."
"We nailed him anyway."
"Could have gone bad, though. You were lucky. Anyway, the son of a bitch deserved shooting."
"No argument there," he said.
"Well, I didn't mean it about your condo."
"Yes, you did."
"Okay, I did. But I have a different take on it now. It's a screwed-up world, and we all need to have a way of coping. Yours is better than most. Better than mine, in fact.
You know what I think's happening here? I think maybe this is what the psychologists call bonding."
"God, I hope not."
"I think it is." She smiled.
"I suspect that already happened weeks or months ago, but we're just getting around to admitting it."
They stood in companionable silence for a while. He wondered how much time had passed since they'd fled from the Counting Golem on Pacific Coast Highway. He felt as if he had surely been on the run for an hour, but it was difficult to tell real time when you were not living in it. The longer they were stuck in the pause, the more inclined Harry was to believe their enemy's promise that the ordeal would last only 1 hour. He had a feeling, perhaps at least partly cop instinct, rather than entirely wishful thinking, that Tick-Tock was not as all-powerful as he seemed, that there were limits to even his phenomenal abilities, and that engineering the pause was so draining he could not long sustain it. The growing inner cold that troubled both him and Connie might be a sign that Tick-Tock was finding it increasingly difficult to exempt them from the enchantment that had stilled the rest of the world. In spite of their tormentor's attempt to control the altered reality that he had created, perhaps Harry and Connie were gradually being transformed from movable game pieces to permanent fixtures on the game board itself. He remembered that shock of hearing the gravelly voice speak to him out of his car radio last evening when he had been speeding between his burning condo in Irvine and Connie's apartment in Costa Mesa. But until now, he had not realized the importance of the words the golem vagrant had spoken.
"Gotta rest now, hero. Gotta rest. Tired. A little nap."
More had been said, mostly threats, the raspy voice gradually fading into static silence. However, Harry suddenly understood that the most important thing about the incident was not the fact that Tick-Tock could somehow control the ether and speak to him out of a radio, but the revelation that even this being of godlike abilities had limits and needed periodic rest like any ordinary mortal. When Harry thought about it, he realized that each of Tick-Tock's more flamboyant manifestations was always followed by a period of an hour or longer when he didn't come around to continue his torments.
Gotta rest, hero. Tired. Little nap.
He remembered telling Connie earlier at her apartment that even a sociopath with enormous paranormal powers was certain to have weaknesses, points of vulnerability. During the intervening hours, as he had seen Tick-Tock perform a series of tricks, each of which was more amazing than the one before it, he had grown more pessimistic about their chances. Now, optimism blossomed again.
Gotta rest, hero. Tired. A little nap.
He was about to share these hopeful thoughts with Connie when she suddenly stiffened. His arm was still around her waist, so he also felt her shivering abruptly stop. For an instant, he was afraid that she had been too deeply chilled, surrendered to entropy, and become part of the pause. Then he saw that she had tilted her head in response to some faint sound that he, in his wool gathering, had not heard. It came again. A click. Then a low scrape. A much louder clatter. The sounds were all flat, truncated, like those they themselves had made during their long run from the coast highway. Alarmed, Connie slipped her arm from around Harry's waist, and he let go of her as well. Down on the main floor of the warehouse, the golem vagrant moved through iron shadows and revealing shafts of frozen light, between the zombie spectators and among the petrified dancers. Tick-Tock had entered through the same door they had used, following their trail. Connie's instinct was to step back from the loft railing so the golem would not look up and see her, but she overcame that reflexive urge and remained motionless. In the fathomless stillness of the pause, even the whispery friction of shoe sole against floor, or the softest creak of a board, would instantly draw the creature's unwanted attention. Harry was also quick enough to slam a lock on his instinctual reaction, remaining almost as still as any of the ravers caught in the pause. Thank God. If the thing looked up, it probably would not see them. Most of the light was below, and the loft hung in shadows. She realized she was clinging to the stupid hope that Tick-Tock really was trailing them only with ordinary senses, keeping his promise, as if any sociopathic serial killer, paranormally empowered or not, could be trusted to keep a promise. Stupid, not worthy of her, but she clung to the possibility anyway. If the world could fall under enchantment as profound as any in a fairy tale, who was to say that her own hopes and wishes did not also have at least some power? And wasn't that an odd idea coming from her, of all people, who had given up hope as a child, who had never in memory wished for any gift or blessing or surcease? Everyone can change, they said. She had never believed it. For most of her life she had been unchanging, expecting nothing from the world that she did not earn twice over, taking perverse solace from the fact that her expectations were never exceeded. Life can be as bitter as dragon tears, but whether dragon tears are bitter or sweet depends entirely on how each man perceives the taste. Or woman. Now she felt a stirring within, an important change, and she wanted to live to see how it played out. But below prowled the golem vagrant, hunting. Connie breathed through her open mouth, slowly, quietly. Moving among the fossilized dancers, the massive creature turned its burly head left and then right, methodically scanning the crowd. It changed color as it passed through frozen lasers and spotlights, red to green, green to yellow, yellow to red, to white, to green, gray and black when it moved between shafts of light. But always its eyes were blue, radiant and strange. When the space between dancers narrowed, the golem shoved aside a young man in jeans and a blue corduroy jacket. The dancer toppled backward, but the resistance of all paused things prevented him from completing the fall. He stopped at a 45-degree angle to the floor and hung there precariously, still poised mid-dance, with the same celebratory expression on his face, ready to complete the fall in the first fraction of a second after time started up again, if it ever did. Moving from front to back of the cavernous room, the hulking golem shoved other dancers aside into falls and spins and tumbles and head-butting collisions that would not be completed until the pause ended. Getting out of the building safely when real time kicked in again would be a challenge, because the startled ravers, never having seen the beast pass among them while they were paused, would blame those around them for being knocked down and shoved. A dozen fights would erupt in the first half minute, pandemonium would break out, and confusion would inevitably give way to panic. With lasers and spotlights sweeping the crowd, the throbbing bass of the techno music shaking the walls, and violence inexplicably erupting at every turn, the rush to get out would pile people up at the doors, and it would be a miracle if a number of them were not trampled to death in the melee. Connie had no special sympathy for the mob on the dance floor, since defiance of the law and policemen was one of the motivations that brought them to a rave in the first place. But as rebellious and destructive and socially confused as they might be, they were nonetheless human beings, and she was outraged at the callousness with which Tick-Tock was bullying through them without a thought for what would happen to them when the world suddenly shifted into gear again. She glanced at Harry beside her and saw a matching anger in his face and eyes. His teeth were clenched so tight that his jaw muscles bulged, and there was nothing they could do to stop what was happening below. Bullets had no effect, and Tick-Tock was not likely to respond to a heartfelt request. Besides, by speaking out, they would only be revealing their presence. The golem vagrant had not once glanced toward the loft, and as yet there was no reason to think either that Tick-Tock was using more than ordinary senses to search for them, or that he knew they were in the warehouse. Then Tick-Tock perpetrated an outrage that made it clear he fully intended to cause bedlam and leave bloody tumult in his wake. He stopped in front of a raven-haired girl of 20, whose slender arms were raised above her head in one of those rapturous expressions of the joy that rhythmic movement and primitive driving music could sometimes bring a dancer to, even without the assistance of drugs. He loomed over her for a moment, studying her as if taken with her beauty. Then he grabbed one of her arms in both his monstrous hands, wrenching with shocking violence, and tore it out of her shoulder socket. A low, wet laugh escaped him as he threw the arm behind him, where it hung in the air between two other dancers. The mutilation was as bloodless as if he had merely disconnected the arm of a mannequin, but of course blood would not begin to flow until time itself flowed again. Then the madness of the act and its consequences would be all too apparent. Connie squeezed her eyes shut, unable to watch what he might do next. As a homicide cop, she had seen countless acts of mindless barbarity, or the consequences of them, and she had collected stacks of newspaper stories about crimes of positively fiendish brutality, and she had seen the damage this particular psychotic bastard had done to poor Ricky Estefan. But the fierce savagery of the act he committed on the dance floor rocked her as nothing had before. The utter helplessness of this young victim might have been the difference that knocked the wind out of Connie and left her shaking not from any inner or outer chill, but with icy horror. All victims were helpless to one degree or another. That was why they became targets for the savages among them. But this pretty young woman's helplessness was of an infinitely more terrible nature, for she had never seen her assailant coming, would never see him go, or know his identity, would be stricken as suddenly as any innocent field mouse pierced by the razor claws of a swooping hawk which it had never seen diving from on high. Even after she had been maimed, she remained unaware of the attack, frozen in the last moment of pure happiness and worry-free existence that she might ever know, a laugh still painted on her face, though she had been forever crippled and perhaps condemned to death, not even permitted to know her loss, or to feel the pain, or to scream until her attacker had returned to her the ability to feel and react. Connie knew that to this monstrous enemy, she was as shockingly vulnerable as the young dancer below, helpless. No matter how fast she could run, regardless of the cleverness of her strategies, no defense would be adequate and no hiding place secure. Although she had never been particularly religious, she suddenly understood how a devout fundamentalist Christian might tremble at the thought that Satan could be loosed from hell to stalk the world and wreak Armageddon. His awesome power, his relentlessness, his hard, gleeful, merciless brutality. Greasy nausea slithered in her guts, and she was afraid she might throw up. Beside her, the softest hiss of apprehension escaped Harry, and Connie opened her eyes. She was determined to meet her death face to face with all the resistance she could muster, useless as resistance might be. On the floor of the warehouse below, the golem vagrant reached the foot of the same set of stairs up which she and Harry had climbed to the loft. He hesitated there as if considering whether to turn and walk away, search elsewhere. Connie dared to hope that their continued silence, in spite of every provocation to cry out, had encouraged Tick-Tock to believe that they could not possibly be hiding anywhere in the rave. Then he spoke in that rough, demonic voice.
"Free, fi, fo, fum," he said, starting up the stairs. "I smell the blood of hero cops."
His laugh was as cold and inhuman as any sound that might issue from a crocodile, yet contained an eerily recognizable quality of childlike delight. Arrested development. A psychotic child. She remembered Harry telling her that the burning vagrant, in the process of destroying the condominium, had said,
"You people are so much fun to play with."
This was his private game, played by his rules, or without rules at all, if he wished, and she and Harry were nothing but his toys. She had been foolish to hope that he would keep his promise. The crash of each of his heavy footsteps reverberated across the wood treads and up through the entire structure. The floor of the loft shook from his ascent. He was climbing fast.
Boom, 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 boom.
Harry grabbed her by the arm. "Quick, the other stairs." They turned away from the railing and toward the opposite end of the loft from where the golem was ascending. At the head of the second set of stairs stood a second golem identical to the first. Huge, mane of tangled hair, wild beard, raincoat like a black cape. He was grinning broadly, blue flames flickering brightly in deep sockets. Now they knew one more thing about the extent of Tick-Tock's power. He could create and control at least two artificial bodies at the same time. The first golem reached the top of the stairs to their right. He started toward them, ruthlessly kicking a path through the tangled lovers on the floor. To their left, the second golem approached with no greater respect for the paused people in his way. When the world started up again, cries of injury and outrage would arise from end to end of the wide loft. Still gripping Connie's arm, pulling her back against the railing, Harry whispered, "Jump!"
Boom, 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 boom.
The thud of the twin golem's footsteps shook the loft, and boom, 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 boom. The pounding of her heart shook Connie, and the two sounds became indistinguishable from one another. Following Harry's example, she put her hands behind her on the railing, pushed up to sit on the handrail. The golems kicked more viciously at the human obstacles between them and their prey, closing in faster from both sides. She lifted her legs and swung around to face the warehouse, at least a 20-foot drop to the floor. Far enough to break a leg? Crack open her skull? Probably. Each of the golems was less than 20 feet away, coming toward her with all the irresistible force of freight trains, gas flame eyes burning as hot as any fires in hell, reaching for her with massive hands. Harry jumped. With a cry of resignation, Connie pushed with her feet against the balusters and her hands against the handrail, launching herself into the void, and fell only 6 or 7 feet before coasting to a full stop in midair beside Harry. She was facing straight down, legs and arms spread in an unconscious imitation of the classic skydiving position, and below her were the frozen dancers, all of them as oblivious of her as they were of everything else beyond the instant when they had been spellbound. The deepening chill in her bones and the rapid depletion of her energy as they fled through Laguna Beach had indicated that she was not making her way through the paused world as easily as it seemed, certainly not as easily as she moved through the normal world. The fact that they did not create their own wind when they ran, which Harry also noticed, seemed to support the idea that resistance to their motion was present even if they were not conscious of it, and now the arrested fall proved it. As long as they exerted themselves, they could keep moving, but they could not rely on momentum or even the pull of gravity to carry them far when exertion ceased. Looking over her shoulder, Connie saw that she had managed to launch herself outward only 5 feet from the loft railing, though she had shoved away from it with all her might. However, combined with a 5 or 6 foot vertical drop, she had gone far enough to be beyond the reach of the golems. They stood at the loft railing, leaning out, reaching down, grasping for her, but coming up with only handfuls of empty air. Harry shouted at her, "You can move if you try!" She saw that he was using his arms and legs somewhat in the manner of a swimmer doing a breaststroke, angled toward the floor, pulling himself downward by agonizing inches as if the air wasn't air at all but some curious form of extremely dense water. She quickly realized she was unfortunately not weightless like an astronaut in orbit aboard the space shuttle and enjoyed none of the motive advantages of a gravity-free environment. A brief experiment proved she couldn't propel herself with an astronaut's ease or change direction on a whim. When she imitated Harry, however, Connie found that she could pull herself down through the gluey air if she was methodical and determined. For a moment, it seemed even better than skydiving, because the period of the dive when you had the illusion of flying like a bird was at comparatively high altitudes, and with features on the ground rapidly enlarging, the illusion was never fully convincing. Here, on the other hand, she was right over the heads of other people and airborne within a building, which even under the circumstances gave her an exhilarating sense of power and buoyancy, rather like one of those blissful dreams of flying that too seldom informed her sleep. Connie actually might have enjoyed the bizarre experience if Tick-Tock had not been present in the form of the two golems and if she had not been fleeing for her life. She heard the boom, 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 boom of their heavy, hurried footsteps on the wooden loft, and when she looked back over her shoulder and up, she saw they were headed for opposite sets of stairs. She was still 10 or 11 feet from the warehouse floor and swimming downward at an infuriatingly slow speed, inch by grinding inch through the colorful fixed beams of the spotlights and party lasers, gasping for breath from exertion, getting rapidly colder now, colder. If there had been something solid for her to push against, such as a nearby wall or roof-supporting column, she'd have been able to achieve greater propulsion. But there was nothing besides the air itself off which to launch, almost like trying to lift herself entirely by her own bootstraps. To her left, Harry was about a foot ahead of her, but making no better time than she was. He was farther along only because he had started sooner. Kick. Pull the arms. Struggle. Her sense of freedom and buoyancy swiftly gave way to a feeling of being trapped. Boom, 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 boom. The footfalls of their pursuers echoed flatly through the huge chamber. She was perhaps 9 feet off the floor, moving toward a clear space among the dancers. Kick, pull, kick and pull. Keep moving, moving. So cold. She glanced over her shoulder again, even though she was afraid that the act of doing so would slow her down. At least one of the golems had reached the head of one set of stairs. He descended the steps two at a time, in his cloak-like raincoat, shoulders hunched, burly head lowered, leaping down in the rollicking manner of an ape. He reminded her of an illustration in a long-forgotten storybook, a picture of an evil troll from some medieval legend. Struggling so fiercely that her heart felt as if it might explode, she drew herself within 8 feet of the floor. But she was angled head first. She would have to pull herself laboriously all the way to the concrete, which would provide the first solid surface against which she could regain her equilibrium and scramble to her feet.
Boom, 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 boom.
The golem reached the bottom of the stairs. Connie was exhausted, freezing. She heard Harry cursing the cold and the resisting air. The pleasant dream of flying had become the most classic of all nightmares, in which the dreamer could flee only in slow motion, while the monster pursued with terrifying speed and agility. Concentrating on the floor below, 7 feet from it now, Connie nevertheless saw movement from the corner of her left eye and heard Harry cry out. A golem had reached him. A darker shadow fell across the shadow-layered floor directly below her. Reluctantly, she turned her head to the right. Suspended in midair with her feet above and behind her like an angel swooping down to do battle with a demon, she found herself face to face with the other golem. Regrettably,
Unlike an angel, she was not armed with a fiery sword, a bolt of lightning, or an amulet blessed by God and capable of knocking demons back into the fires and boiling tar of the pit. Grinning, Tick-Tock gripped her throat. The golem's hand was so enormous that the thick fingers overlapped the fat thumb where they met at the back of the head, completely encircling her neck, though it did not immediately crush her windpipe and cut off her breath. She remembered how Rikia Stefan's head had been turned backward on his shoulders, and how the raven-haired dancer's slender arm had been ripped so effortlessly from her body. A flash of rage burned away her terror, and she spat in the huge and terrible face.
"Let go of me, shithead!"
A foul exhalation washed over her, making her grimace, and the scar-faced golem vagrant said,
"Congratulations, bitch! Time's up!"
The blue flame eyes burned brighter for an instant, then winked out, leaving deep black sockets beyond which it seemed that Connie could see to the end of eternity. The vagrant's hideous face, writ large on this oversized golem, was abruptly transformed from flesh and hair into a highly detailed monochromatic brown countenance that appeared to have been sculpted from clay or mud. An elaborate web of hairline cracks formed from the bridge of his nose, swiftly spinning into a spiral pattern across his face, and in a wink, his features crumbled. The giant vagrant's entire body dissolved, and with a shattering detonation of techno music that resumed full blast in mid-note, the world started up again. No longer suspended in the air, Connie fell the last 7 feet to the warehouse floor, face first into the moist mound of dirt and sand and grass and rotting leaves and bugs that had been the golem's body, cushioned from injury by the now lifeless mass, but gagging and spitting in disgust. Around her, even above the pounding music, she heard screams of shock, terror, and pain.
"Game's over. For now," the golem vagrant said,
then obligingly dissolved.